Building Bridges production for Women's History Month, produced by Mimi Rosenberg. Last year marked the 62nd anniversary of the original blacklist document, Red Channels. This small pamphlet ignited a firestorm of mostly unfounded accusations, which continued unchecked for years. Individuals identified as communists, sympathizers, or fellow travelers soon found their profession and personal lives in chaos, and many never fully recovered. Illness, substance abuse, shattered families, and even suicide became the norm for many formerly successful artists and writers. One third of these artists were women. Most material about this period focuses on Hollywood, and more specifically on men, while their suffering and that of their families should never be ignored or minimized. Little has been written about blacklisted women, particularly those who made their careers in New York. While the Broadway community was certainly more congenial to blacklisted artists than Hollywood, the majority of blacklisted women found themselves unexpectedly out of work and were never able to fully reclaim their careers. And now, excerpts from a play. The Diminished Fifth brings high-profile women together in a fictionalized setting. The events depicted are historically documented, but certain details of the women's relationships come from the imagination of the playwright. We now experience the personal and professional struggles of celebrated wit Dorothy Parker, writer Lillian Hellman, actress and broadcaster Jean Muir, as they find their reputations and personal freedom compromised almost overnight. While the accusations leveled at these individuals seemed ridiculous to us today, it certainly could. It is happening again. Diminished Fifth urges us to realize that no matter how often a lie is spoken, it is still a lie. And now, The Diminished Fifth by Julie Halpern. Joseph R. McCarthy was the tongue, the voice, the mark of domestic politics in the United States in the 1950s. The junior senator from Wisconsin in 1946 was elected to the Senate on his war record. Tail Gunner Joe. He was not a tail gunner. He spoke of his wounds. He had no wounds. In 1952, he was awarded the Distinguished Flying Cross for the missions he never flew. Obscure in the halls where senators advise and consent, he advised not at all and consented to small favors, some sugar for the Pepsi-Cola company in the days of rationing, a speech for the Lustron Corporation for $10,000. Most of all, he made the rounds of Washington cocktail parties until February the 9th, 1950. On that day, he discovered communism, as one writer described it, the way Columbus discovered America. With that discovery began the most meteoric political career in our history. February the 9th, 1950. An unknown junior senator. 1 month later, he began living his life in the headlines. Joseph R. McCarthy was a primer for American demagogues. How did it work? Not headlines alone, but also the sanctuary of senatorial immunity. This made for two McCarthys, one speaking from the floor of the Senate, immune from any kind of legal redress, enjoying the freedom of total irresponsibility. For example, McCarthy referred to Professor Owen Lattimore as the architect of the policy of treason in the Far East. Lattimore challenged McCarthy to repeat the phrase off the Senate floor. McCarthy did not, and in fact, when asked directly by a reporter about Professor Lattimore, he replied, "I think he's extremely dangerous." A powerful committee chairman can turn a Senate hearing into a star chamber. Witnesses before McCarthy were not permitted to cross-examine. They were not allowed to confront their accusers or even find out who they were. McCarthy relied heavily on what he called the loyal American underground. Oh, these were nuts, cranks, frustrates, and super patriots who produced leaks and rumors for the junior senator. Another McCarthy device, the professional paid informer. These included Harvey Mattuso, who confessed to being a communist in many parts of the United States, who named hundreds of names. Mattuso broke down and counter-confessed. It was all a lie. He did it for the money. He did it because he wanted to belong. Because the FBI, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and Senator McCarthy wanted him to. Having told the truth, he was sentenced to 5 years for perjury. Most of the hearings McCarthy held were closed, and no one knew anything about them. But all America was complicit. Senator Taft backed McCarthy all the way. He said, "Whether Senator McCarthy has legal evidence, whether he has overstated his case, is of lesser importance. The question is whether communist influence in the State Department still exists." Taft's complicity meshed with his presidential aspirations. He needed a bully boy to slug the Democrats. McCarthy was it. Harry Truman defined McCarthyism one way. "It is now evident that the present administration has fully embraced for political advantage McCarthyism." I'm not referring to the senator from Wisconsin. He's only important in that his name is taken on a dictionary meaning in the world. And that meaning is the corruption of truth, the abandonment of our historical devotion to fair play. It is the abandonment of due process of law. It is the use of the big lie and the unfounded accusation against any citizen in the name of Americanism and security. It is the rise to power of the demagogue who lives on untruth. It is the spread of fear and the destruction of faith in every level of our society. I feel McCarthyism is an American political attitude of the mid-20th century, closely allied to know-nothing-ism, and characterized chiefly by opposition to elements held to be subversive, and by the use of tactics involving personal attacks on individuals by means of wildly publicized, indiscriminate allegations, especially on the basis of unsubstantiated charges. And now Julie Halpern discusses The Diminished Fifth, a new play about women who were blacklisted. Julie, the women that you bring to life in this play, why these particular women?
When I first started writing this play, I became very interested in the blacklisting. It really played a big part in the 1940s and the 1950s. There was just constant, you know, sniping and really horrible, horrible things said about people when their lives were just wrecked. And I started doing research into the period and into the blacklist, and it really interested me. And a third of the people who were in, I guess, what we would call the original blacklist, there was a pamphlet, tiny little thing, red and black, called Red Channels, that listed real or imagined communists. And all of these ladies ended up on that list, much to their surprise. Actually, Essie Robeson is not on it. She was blacklisted earlier along with her husband, probably in the 40s. A lot of this goes way back to the 40s, you know, the original, what we now refer to blacklisting. But a lot of people were targeted much earlier than this, and there were whole dossiers on many performers. And I chose these women for a number of reasons. I chose Jean Muir because when I was reading the book, Those Wonderful Terrible Years, there was a chapter about her. I had never heard of her. And there were a couple of pictures of her. And I just thought, my God, this poor woman who was not really a star, but was known at this time, you know, by most people, at least in the business, her life was wrecked, absolutely wrecked. And lost her marriage and her children. And for a long time, her physical and mental health, her career was not really regained until she was in her 60s. And she's an amazing person. I just thought, my God, you know, nobody knows about this person. And I kind of kept her on my back burner. And then when I started writing this play, I wanted to include, of course, some well-known people. But I was very, very interested in Margaret Webster because I, too, am a director and producer as well as being an actor. I just found her so interesting. I just kept reading and reading and reading. And I think everyone's interested in Paul Robeson. And, of course, I'm always interested in women's history. It's my third play that deals with women in history. So I just thought, my goodness, so many women were blacklisted kind of by association. What Margaret talks about with Essie Robeson. I mean, Essie was a brilliant woman in her own right, had studied to be a doctor, was a scientist, and I think had a couple of degrees from different colleges. She was just somebody who was good at everything. She was also, you know, a very beautiful woman, very fashion forward. I mean, she just was somebody who had everything. And I just thought, my goodness, and she really had such a rough time despite all these fabulous things she had going for her. I think initially they were blacklisted for the same reasons that men were. I don't think, you know, because a third of the original blacklist were women, which of course was a lot when you think of how many women actually had jobs at that point. So it would be different than today. But I think originally, I don't think it was originally meant to do anything particularly to women. I think it was just people in general. I think that what happened as a result of the blacklisting was different. The result was different in that many of the men were able to get their careers back for a number of reasons. And most of the women, really with the exception of Lillian Hellman, had a rough time. Eventually, Margaret Webster was able to go back to work, but not on the same level, and was not treated with the same respect that she had been accorded to previously. And it was very, very hard for her. I mean, what people, I think, don't understand about what happened to you when you were blacklisted is your phone was tapped. You were followed around. There were blacklisted people, both men and women, who had school children who were followed around by the FBI and detained. This did happen. But just being women, and it's an issue today, even more an issue 60 years ago, hard enough to get work under the best of circumstances for women. And it was just harder for them to get back. Most of them were not as famous as the men who were blacklisted. It was just harder for them to regain the momentum.
And now Mary McLowan's Jean Muir, who she fully commits to the depths of her despair, but perseverance to emerge from the blacklist, from the play The Diminished Fifth.
It is a great honor to be speaking before such a distinguished assembly, young women leaders. I am so excited about your future and the world you will make with your talents and determination. I could not be prouder if you were my very own children. You have a difficult job ahead of you, but I am confident you will rise to any challenges that present themselves. As women, we have many choices, and your generation, more than any others before, can choose any career you like and be wives and mothers as well. Each generation has its challenges. You know all about yours, and my struggles are well known to all of you, too. I have been asked to share my story, but it is too complex to be handled in such a short assembly. It is also an overwhelmingly sad story, not an appropriate subject for commencement. Careers and families were destroyed, and the pain continues for many and will never totally go away. I was one of the lucky ones, although I would not have believed it not long ago when I dreaded getting up, answering the phone, wondering if it was tapped, answering the door to God knows what or who, trying to get through the night without a drink. I have to confess that the latter took a long time to overcome, but I did it. I even returned to my career, but always looked over my shoulder. Sometimes those who would destroy me seemed to be always there, hovering, circling like vultures. Each day is a struggle for a recovering alcoholic, but each day brings new hope. When I look into your faces, I know that time will move on, and I pray that your generation will question what is told them. The only wisdom I can share is that you should not believe everything you hear. No matter how many times a lie is spoken, it is still a lie, will always be, and if spread, can hurt others irrevocably. I love the expression, if you are not part of the solution, you are part of the problem. For the rest of my life, I plan to be part of the solution and hope my legacy will be young women who act in faith, not fear. And remember, ladies, despite the pathetic and cowardly actions of some blacklisted colleagues, no blacklisted woman ever turned anyone in, ever. So that is what happened to me. Not the glamorous life I had once known, but productive and useful. Mid-sized towns in Missouri did not have a blacklist, and I was pretty much left alone. I taught until I was 65, and then kept a low profile, directing regional and community theaters, and occasionally acting on TV and even on Broadway. Many of my blacklisted colleagues were not fortunate enough to have had those years to recreate themselves and find some peace. But as I said, I was one of the lucky ones. All I can say is that everything passes eventually. Wounds heal, but with scars that will remain with us always. My ordeal still informs everything I do. But I live in the now. Living in the past forever means the bullies win. Don't let them win. We are only a small part of the story. Over a third of the original blacklist in red channels were women, and even more were blacklisted as the decade went on. But we remember them tonight. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The taller I'll become, the further you take my rights away, the faster I will run. You can deny me, you can decide to turn your face away. No.
Mary, who were you channeling with that speech?
Jean Muir.
Tell us about Jean Muir.
Jean Muir, who was an actress who was blacklisted during this period, and there isn't actually a lot of historical information you can find about her. So in doing research, I went on the internet. I actually did see some YouTube video of her doing Midsummer Night's Dream, which was pretty cool to see. But other than that, a lot of her life is pretty vague. But Julie had a book, Those Wonderful Terrible Years, and it was about AFTRA and how AFTRA was formed. And Jean had been married to Henry Jaffe, who was a lawyer who helped to form AFTRA and then later became somewhat of a jerk. But Jean was also a very big alcoholic. That came about after going through this period and also losing everything, her children, but eventually gaining them back by... I mean, she said she was very lucky, and the reason I think she says she was very lucky is that she went through this awful period of being blacklisted and then becoming this alcoholic and sort of alienating most of the people that she really loved. But then she turned her life around and became a college professor and became very well respected and was able to act again as well. And most of the women did not have any chance to regain their reputation or their lives. I actually see a lot of parallels with what's going on today. I feel very threatened as a woman today by what's going on in Congress and the crazy politicking that's happening right now with women's health care, particularly. Because when the freshman Congress came in with the Tea Party members, particularly, instead of working on jobs or the economy, they tried to pass 900 bills in the first few months against women, taking away rights from women, women's health care and everything else. I take it very personally. We were taught about this in school, but we weren't taught. It was sort of a gall lost over thing. And we were taught about it more like in the way that though there was the Red Scare and communism is really bad, it's kind of what we were told when I was growing up in school. And there's another play, Are You Now or Have You Ever Been? And that, somebody did it in college, so I had been exposed to that and seen, but it was, that was more about men. So you didn't really get a sense of what happened for the women. But this struggle is so awful that you wouldn't want it to happen ever again. So it does sort of stick in your heart and in your head when you learn about it. Definitely because it happened and because it could happen again, I think it's very important to put that out there and put the human face on people who had their reputations tarnished. And I think there's a big danger in the way that society can be, in that if someone is accused of something, I know we live in a society where you're supposed to be innocent and proven guilty, but that was clearly not the case with these women. And I do know, having researched some other things, like people who have been on death row, who they are finding now with the new DNA evidence that those people actually shouldn't be there. It's the same kind of thing, though, because you get this attitude, well, they were convicted, so they must be guilty. And that's not right. So I think it's very important you show us the human story and real people, and people can say, wow, I didn't know about that, or maybe I did know about that, but now I know more, and I want to make sure that doesn't happen again.
What's your own experience as a working woman who seeks to be in theater?
The simple answer is it's very difficult and very frustrating. I don't think theater will ever go away, but theater is definitely, there's not a lot of money in theater, so there's not a lot out there in terms of trying to get work. There's a lot of people who want to be an actor. A less subset of that are actually actors. And then from there, there's a certain subset of jobs. And the way that the economy has been, a lot of jobs have been going away because there's not enough money to produce them. And so where it used to be, you might be a regional theater actor and you worked in smaller cities around, and then you could come to New York and work on or off Broadway. The case now seems to be that even the A-list actors, the film and television actors, are now taking the jobs that were on Broadway, and the people that were on Broadway are now off and then regional. And so if you're somebody who's trying to work your way up through regional and off Broadway, you're fighting an uphill battle against people who already have a lot of stature or name recognition. And with the internet, it's a lot easier to just put stuff out there on video and things, which is good and bad. I like to say to young women today, there's a lot out there that's sort of demeaning to our brains and our bodies that has come out. And these women grew up in a time where women did not have a lot of choices. I know my mother grew up and she had a choice between being a nun and being able to be a teacher or to go be a nurse or get married. And that was choices. And like today, we have a lot of choices, but there's also a lot of, I feel like it's backlash from men having had a period where after the 50s and 60s and then the sexual revolution and then coming into the 80s with all the Reagan economics. And after that, it seems like we've been so sexualized that I feel like you have to put yourself out there and say, hey, I'm an intelligent woman. And I think looking at women like the women in this play, as well as other women who had different struggles, but struggles that were important in gaining us the kind of freedoms that we have, that we need to remember that the struggle isn't over and that we still have to make sure that we speak up for ourselves, even if it means making some enemies.
What key I want to do to them? Everybody knows that they're guilty. Everybody knows that they've lied. Everybody knows that they're guilty. Resting on their conscience, eating their inside is freedom. Said it's freedom time now. It's freedom. Said it's freedom time now. Time to get free. Or give yourselves up now. It's freedom. Said it's freedom time. Yo, there's a war in the mind over territory for the dominion.
who will dominate the opinions, schisms and isms, keeping us in forms of religion, conforming our vision to the world church's decision, trapped in a section, submitted to committee election, moral infection, epidemic lies and deception, insurrection of the highest possible order, distort, and I take recorders from hearing like underwater, beyond the borders, find ascending disorder, bound by the strategy of systemic depravity, heavy as gravity, head first in the cavity, without a bottom, a fate worse than Sodom. What's got 'em? Drunk off the spirits. Truth comes, we can't hear it when you been.
And now Stacy Scott brings us a reading from her character, the determinedly upbeat Lillian Hellman, a portrait of grace under fire from The Diminished Fifth.
No blacklisted woman has turned in anyone yet. We plead the diminished fifth. In laywoman's terms, it means, ask me anything you want about myself, but I refuse to discuss anyone else. HUAC has complained about women being what they call unfriendly witnesses. Turns out there isn't a friendly one to be found among our ranks. Bastards got so angry with me, they didn't even bother to cite me with a contempt of court charge. What can you expect? She's a woman. Oh. Many of our colleagues are going to sit the trials out in Europe, hoping they will end soon. I understand why they're doing it. Some of them have small children. But if we hide, we look guilty and allow it to continue. Did you know the reason I was first blacklisted was I attended the Waldorf conferences 3 years ago? I only went because Dmitri Shostakovich was speaking. How should I know he'd get up and start shooting his mouth off about Stalin's virtues? I was in Russia during the war and got a first-hand look at what was going on there. Scary as hell.
Stacy Scott and Elaine Legaro portray Lillian Hellman and Dorothy Parker discussing their partners, Dashiell Hammett and Alan Campbell, a screenwriter who was blacklisted after 1950 and ultimately committed suicide. Dashiell Hammett, who testified in 1951 in front of United States District Court Judge Sylvester Ryan, facing questioning by Irving Saipul, the United States Attorney for the Southern District of New York. Irving Saipul, the nation's number one legal hunter of communists. During the hearing, Hammett refused to provide the information the government wanted, specifically the list of contributors to the bail fund, people who might be sympathetic enough to harbor fugitives. Instead, on every question regarding the bail fund, Hammett took the Fifth Amendment, refusing or even identifying his signature or initials on documents the government had subpoenaed. As soon as his testimony concluded, Hammett was found guilty of contempt of court. He was imprisoned.
Dash is dead. Really dead this time. He stopped thinking 2 days ago. He's been a ghost for quite a while, but it's different now. I've stopped feeling him.
Jill has a way of wrecking people's souls. Alan is dead. He took too many sleeping pills. It's my fault. I didn't think anyone actually died from the damn things. I've certainly taken enough of them to know.
Dodd, it's not your fault. Alan always took too many pills, even more than you. His doctor should have cut him off years ago. You can't blame yourself. God knows Dash drank, smoked, and screwed himself to death right in front of me. As much as he loved me, he wouldn't change a bit. But I wouldn't change either, and neither would you. How can we expect men to do what we want them to when we're as outrageous as they are?
Despite my endless criticism, I loved Alan. And he loved me even when I was impossible to love. At least you are a muse. You are immortal. Dash saw to that.
The hell with that. I made myself immortal. And something tells me you won't soon be forgotten, my friend. Focus on the future. That's what I'm going to do. Don't let the bastards bury you.
I can't even get a real job. Alan couldn't either. He couldn't handle being controversial. And I must say I'm getting a bit tired of it. I'm teaching creative writing at community college. Alan kept me at least functional enough to show up. But I was too drunk and depressed to see how low he was. He killed himself, Lily.
You don't know that Alan killed himself. Let yourself mourn without feeling guilty. I'll try to do the same. Then it's back to work for the both of us. Controversial or not. To controversy.
To survival.
To the future.
Mr. President. Hey. Mr. President. We do not agree with this corruption and greed, with this hatred, with this violence that you have made into a science to silence the powers of so many for this eternal peace.
Major combat operations.
Mr. President! Mr. President! We do not agree with the bomb to stop the bomb, with the bomb to get along. These consequences don't make sense. Your own people reject this offense of guns and greed, high-strung need,
oil addiction, pain affliction.
Power plays diplomatic charades,
elections rigged, new president made.
Smoke screens hide to the sun on the rest of the world. Oil pipelines, meanwhile your lies fly like a Mayday parade. Guns on display, we won't support our government today. No agreements today. No agreements tomorrow.
I want to know more about your characters. Lillian Hellman, Dorothy Parker, Dashiell Hammett, all these names here.
Lillian Hellman was a very famous playwright and screenwriter. She and Dashiell Hammett had a long, long relationship. They never married, but they were like a married couple, and they would part and come together. They had a rather volatile relationship, but there's no question that they loved each other, and she felt extremely supported by him. She was definitely very outspoken and extremely bright, and she wasn't going to take the stuff that they were dishing out, the McCarthyism and the blacklisting. As she said, I'll plead the diminished fifth. She wrote a letter basically saying that you can ask me what you want about me. I have no secret what I've done, but I am not going to name names. I'm not going to play that game. And she actually helped other people feel strong enough to be able to do the same thing.
What do you think about her?
Oh, she's amazing. I actually wish there had been more I could find on her speaking. There was very little that I could find, but of course, there's tons of stuff to read. Her writings are numerous. There is some talk that in her, a lot of her memoirs, that she tends to exercise literary license, and people have accused her of making things up, but she tells a damn good story. And certainly, I'm sure most of it is based on real events that have happened to her.
What happened to her career as a result of McCarthyism, the
she
blacklist?
She definitely was affected, but unlike somebody like Jean Muir, who really wasn't a household name the way Lillian Hellman was, she wasn't totally ruined. She was able to continue to write and work on projects. She did survive that period and did more things afterward.
Elaine.
Incredible, unique women. Just so courageous, especially during those days. For women to take the kind of stands that they did was very special. Today, there's not all the support around that we need, but much, much more support around than years and years ago. I mean, this is going back to the 50s. That's over 60 years ago. For women during that period of time, with everything that they had against them and working against them, these women were so, so courageous.
I think an attorney like Lynn Stewart, who is in her 70s, who has been sentenced to 10 years in jail, which is effectively a life sentence. She is a cancer survivor, but just expressed herself and has been a champion of human rights throughout her own legal career. So when we talk about the 50s, I still see that this is an echo that has meaning and significance for what can happen to people who have some protestation against the status quo, particularly at time when we're in a post 9/11 period. Do you feel that as well?
Definitely keep cycling back, it seems like. Certainly with all the conservatism now, a lot of the rights that we've gained as women, they're being challenged, and there's always this threat that we're going to be stepping back and having to refight some of these battles that we've already won. We're holding on as tightly as we can. But I do think that we are in an environment now that we have made some progress, and women do certainly have many more rights and advantages and opportunities than they had back in the 50s. But there still is a risk in speaking your mind and speaking out against, as you say, the status quo.
Is it even worse than that? I'm focusing on college students who are Muslim, who had their websites surveilled, to have a plant to surveil these students who went on a boating trip for no reason beyond the fact that they were Muslim. For me, this play just hammers me with the dangerous period and the lessons that were not learned about intrusion and surveillance and limitation of people's speech. Elaine, do you have any thoughts how the two connect? Do you see that in the characters in this play?
The word that comes to my mind is the word fear. I think that all this negativity and all this upset in this country and in the world and where women are concerned and the stoppage of progress and accomplishment, the positive road that we should be going down, is all stemming from fear. As a matter of fact, this play opens with a monologue about fear. Fear is a killer.
Well, what about the politics of these women? They were leftists. They were activists. They were advocates for human rights. Where does that play into this incredible victimization that they were subject to by virtue of the McCarthy period? Lillian Hellman, political woman.
She definitely had strong opinions, but I think she, like a lot of the people, got caught up in this. I mean, she was socializing with other people who had leftist leanings, wanted more freedoms. They don't want to just be put into a box and be told, well, this is what you do. It's like, no, I'm a thinking person, and this isn't fair, and that's not fair, and why should we do this, and we need to make some changes. And McCarthy and his crones just wanted to lump all that into, well, then you're a communist. She never considered herself necessarily a communist. She went to certain meetings and things because, again, as I say, they were saying important things and she was around people that she respected, but that didn't necessarily mean she was a card-carrying communist, and a lot of the people there weren't. But the government at the time wanted to be able to pigeonhole people because, as Elaine was saying, fear was rampant, and it's running rampant again, and it's so easy to just say, okay, well, we're right and you're wrong, and now it seems to be, since 9/11, of course, well, then we're just going to group everybody, any Muslim is that's the bad guy. So a piece like this is an excellent reminder of where we were and where we do not need to go again.
And now, Elaine Lagaro's Margaret Webster from The Diminished Fifth. It was a terrible time to be a woman of social consciousness operating outside the kitchen in America. Since you were talking about fear, you're going to be doing a monologue. In whose persona are you going to be reciting that monologue?
Margaret Webster. Fear, an acronym for false evidence appearing real. I never thought when I let a lover into my bed that J. Edgar Hoover was snuggled in between us, taking copious notes. The story I shall try to tell is personal and small, only peripheral to main events, but important because, incredible or no, it could happen again. To be afraid is a very humiliating experience, despising yourself for what you fear, and fear is a very evil thing. I gave Jose the opportunity of a lifetime. My production made him a star. Why on earth did he turn me into UAC? Paul and Udo were blacklisted too, but they didn't turn people in. I heard that UAC told him to name three people and then he could go home. I can't believe that was true.
What does that say to you?
Shame on you. Jose Ferrer. He was the one who brought up Margaret Webster's name to the committee. HUAC.
The House Un-American Activities Committee. And what happened to Margaret Webster as
well,
a result?
Well, she was brought before that HUAC and McCarthy's Senate Committee a number of times. It was horrendous. And for him to name anyone, that was as bad as being blacklisted. It really was, as far as I'm concerned. How do you name colleagues? How do you get involved that deeply into an era that was horrendous and devastating, destroyed people's lives, their health, their families? How do you name people? How do you turn somebody in? Margaret Webster, by the way, was not just an actress, but she was also a writer, a producer, a director. She was the first person to bring Shakespeare to Broadway and the first person to cast a black actor in the role of Othello, and that person was Paul Robeson. And she was acting since she was a child. She ended up going back to England because she found so much more peace and relaxation and comfort there after all the blacklisting trial and tribulations. She also was on council at Actors Equity, and I think she was also responsible for the off-Broadway movement and the regional theater movement. Margaret Webster was also interviewed by the FBI. They kept calling her back. It wasn't just the House Un-American Activities Committee. She went before them. Then she went before the McCarthy Senate Subcommittee. Louis Neiser was one of her lawyers, and so was Sidney Davis. And Sidney Davis told Margaret Webster before she went before these committees, he said to her, quote, "Say as little as you can, never elaborate, never, never say no. Vagueness was very essential."
Julie, is this play clearly of great historic value, a feminist perspective? Is it also an admonition for the moment that we are living in?
Yes. I wrote this play. It's very interesting because there's, I think, as Mary pointed out, there's been a couple of other plays about the blacklist, and they've been very, very good plays. And what I wanted to get from my play, this play was written for people of my generation and for the next. The people who lived through it know what it was like. They were there. And they have, of course, their own experience for being part of that world. But one of the reasons I set the final scene in 1970, when Jean Muir has now established herself as a college professor, is that I'm putting into historical perspective, I'm trying to, for women of my age group who were really starting to realize their power as women, who were in large numbers seeking higher education and wanting to participate. It's a message that there's so much work to do. We are now the people who can do it. We need to take action. We can't just sit around. What concerns me, we're almost in a way post-feminist, that we take so many things for granted, especially younger people. They don't know what it's like for abortion to be illegal. People in my age group, when I was a young teenager, it was still illegal. And people still had illegal abortions, and they could be very scary and dangerous. I think it's so out of the public mind now, because there's not that many people who remember it. What frightens me is that people are so willing to give away gains that many, many women and some men worked very, very hard to give us certain freedoms. We haven't had the vote that long, really. It's less than 100 years. And a lot of women don't vote. Why is that? We still don't have enough women running for public office, although it's much better. There are certain things that we can do. I'm not sure why, as a group, we don't do more.
But why present this in the context of a blacklist or this rigid, hierarchical, powerful government repression of people who spoke out? People, indeed, communists who had the right to express themselves.
Yes, they were, yeah.
And people who may have been sympathizers of social justice movements.
Well, I think what we need to understand also in the context of the play, there was so much fear at the end of the Second World War. The repercussions and things that really went on, the Cold War, that people seem to have forgotten about the Cold War, but it certainly was a huge part of life in this country. Fear that Elaine talks about, that my characters talk about, fear of anything that could be interpreted as being communist. There were many groups that were just anti-communist. I remember being a little girl and seeing a film in school that was put out by an anti-communist group. There was a picture of a globe, and then slowly being covered in like what looked like red paint that had been created to scare and terrify people. And again, I was not an adult during the time. I can't comment what it might be like to fear communism so much that you would deprive people of their rights. But that seems to be what happened.
Could you see that today?
Sure. I think any time that people are frightened, and again, fear is the through line of my play, what people will do when they're frightened. You know, desperate people. If you study history, throughout history, you've seen horrible acts committed by people who were desperate and justified it in, well, I was hungry, I needed food, or I did it for this reason or that reason. And there's always, in the minds of people who would abuse somebody else, some justification for doing it. I don't think most people just thought, I feel like depriving someone of their right. Many people, I think, who were part of the blacklisting process thought they were helping the country. I think they really were in such a mindset that they thought they were saving our country from a menace. But they became so zealous about it that they forgot that these are human beings and that we have free speech in this country and we have the right to move about freely without being followed around. And what happened in the 50s is they had so many newspapers. We can't, in my lifetime, I don't remember there being 10 newspapers in a major city, but there were. And there were gossip columnists, and there were a lot of radio shows. Certain people really were just tools of this blacklisting. And so you would hear it. You'd be sitting in your house, driving in your car, and you'd be hearing this stuff day after day after day. You'd read about it. So everywhere you looked, there was this rhetoric coming down on people. And so what happens is that you're so bombarded with this information.
Julie, what was McCarthyism? What do you understand or see this blacklist, UAC, all these committees? To
well,
what aim?
I think it was manipulating people's emotions so they could grab and maintain power over people. They were narcissistic, some of them. A number of them have had substance abuse problems that, you know, there were, each person was different. But I think what they shared was this desire to just have power and really clamp down on anybody who might speak out against them. That history is still being written. I mean, it really is. And it's still being played out. People were blacklisted into the late 60s. And supposedly some people who were still blacklisted as late as 1972. And it really went on a very long time. Some people think it didn't end until the 80s in Hollywood. New York was different. It was so insidious. It's almost impossible to get a grip on what must have been the mentality of many people in this country that they would think this was okay. That's what makes me frightened. You're always going to have a few bad politicians. But the fact that they were allowed to spend time and taxpayers' money and were allowed to use the media in such an abusive fashion and that certain media went along with it. There's so many people who were involved in it. You know, McCarthyism is a term, but it's much greater than that. It was a real attack on any type of artistic, intellectual, speech freedom of any thinking individual in this country, communist or not. That's the way that I look at it.
People always talk about man's inhumanity to man. But what you're trying to do to make this a better land? Just pick up your paper, turn on your TV. You see a lot of demonstration for equality. But folks wouldn't have to suffer if there was no love. But these are trying times, yeah.
Perhaps the best description of the abomination of McCarthyism and its admonition for us is Emma Goldman's Patriotism, a Menace to Liberty. recited here by Sandra Oh.
Is it love of one's birthplace, the place of childhood's recollections and hopes, dreams and aspirations? Patriotism, sir, is the last resort of scoundrels. Said Dr. Johnson, Leo Tolstoy, the greatest anti-patriot of our times, defines patriotism as the principle that will justify the training of wholesale murderers, a trade that requires better equipment for the exercise of man-killing than the making of such necessities of life as shoes, clothing, and houses, a trade that guarantees better returns and greater glory than that of the average working man. Indeed, conceit, arrogance, and egotism are the essentials of patriotism. Let me illustrate. Patriotism assumes that our globe is divided into little spots, each one surrounded by an iron gate. Those who have had the fortune of being born onto some particular spot consider themselves better, nobler, grander, more intelligent than the living beings inhabiting any other spot. It is, therefore, the duty of everyone living on that chosen spot to fight, kill, and die in the attempt to impose his superiority upon all the others. The inhabitants of all the other spots reason in like manner, of course, with the result that, from early infancy, the mind of the child is poisoned with the blood-curdling stories about the Germans, the French, the Italians, the Russians, etc. When the child has reached manhood, he is thoroughly saturated with the belief that he is chosen by the Lord himself to defend his country against attack or invasion of any foreigner. It is for that purpose that we are clamoring for a greater army, a navy, more battleships and ammunition. We Americans claim to be a peace-loving people. We hate bloodshed. We are opposed to violence. Yet we go into spasms of joy over the possibility of projecting dynamite bombs from flying machines upon helpless citizens. Our hearts swell with pride at the thought that America is becoming the most powerful nation on earth and that it will eventually plant her iron foot on the necks of all other nations. Such is the logic of patriotism. Thinking men and women the world over are beginning to realize that patriotism is too narrow and limited a conception to meet the necessities of our time. The centralization of power has brought into being an international feeling of solidarity among the oppressed nations of the world, a solidarity which represents a greater harmony of interests between the working men of America and his brothers abroad than between the American miner and his exploiting compatriot. A solidarity which fears not foreign invasion, because it is bringing all the workers to the point when they will say to their masters, "Go and do your own killing. We have done it long enough for you."
It could have been me, but instead it was you. So I'll keep doing the work you were doing as if I were too. I'll be a student of life, a singer of songs, a farmer of food, and the writer of wrong. It could have been me, but instead it was you. And it may be me, dear sisters and brothers, before we are through. But if you can work for freedom, 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 if you can work for freedom, I can too. They sing at the line of fire. El pueblo unido jamás será vencido.
has been a Building Bridges production for Women's History Month, produced by Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash. Special thanks to Julie Halpern, writer and director of The Diminished Fifth, for her participation and the use of excerpts from her play, along with its actresses, Elaine Legaro, Mary McLowan, and Stacey Scott. Our music was provided by Sheila Gathright, Pink, Lauren Hill, Holly Neer, Roberta Flack, and Fela.
But instead it was you. And it may be we, dear sisters and brothers, before we are through.